Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. Welcome to the LSE, and welcome to this Forum event on what is it really like to be a bat? The Forum is an independent charity that runs events here at the LSE. If you'd like to listen to podcasts of some of our past events, or if you'd like to support some of our events to help keep them free and open to everyone, please have a look at our website, philosophyforum.org. Today's event is on the science and philosophy of bats. I'm very much hoping that you've heard nothing about either of these things before this evening, in which case it will be an hour and a half of great revelations. The questions we're going to be talking about, how can we gain insight into what it's like to be a bat by studying their behavior? What's it like to navigate the world using echolocation? And to what extent does echolocation resemble the ways of perceiving with which we're familiar, like sight and hearing? And what can we learn from bats about the nature of perception and the nature of consciousness? And I'm very pleased to be joined by two experts who come to this topic from very different directions. Alison Fairbrass, postdoctoral researcher in biodiversity at UCL, and Craig French, assistant professor of philosophy at the University of Nottingham. To give you a sense of the format for this event, we'll talk a bit first about the science of bats, and then invite some questions from you on that. And then towards the second half of the event, we'll switch more to philosophy and ask what philosophers can learn from thinking more about what it's like to be a bat. But to start with you, Alison, tell us something about how you came to be interested in bats.
I began in my undergraduate degree becoming very interested in cities and the wildlife that live in cities. And bats are one of the groups of species that manage to get absolutely everywhere in the city. Some species are really sensitive to urban environments, and you won't really find them in very urban environments. But throughout several years of doing research, first in Birmingham and then moving to London, I haven't found a single place that I've surveyed in a city where you didn't find bats as well. So they're really interesting species to study in cities. Some species are more adapted to their urban environment than others, and they can be a really good indicator of the health of an environment as well. So certain species, the presence of certain species will indicate that you have a very healthy habitat. The absence of them might indicate that you don't have such a great habitat. So it's kind of through my interest in cities that I got into working with bats.
Tell us a bit about what your work at the moment with bats involves.
So my work for the last few years has been focused on developing new technology for monitoring wildlife in cities. So that includes all wildlife that lives in cities, as well as bats. I've been developing technology that uses acoustics to monitor wildlife. So because bats use sound to move through their environment, using acoustics is a really great way to monitor bats. So I've been developing new sensors and new algorithms that can be used to monitor bats and other wildlife in cities using sound.
Is this in the Olympic Park, this project?
That is one of the projects, yeah. So in June last year, we deployed the world's first fully autonomous system for monitoring bats in the city. So at the Olympic Park, there's now 15 ultrasonic sensors that are on lampposts, and they're listening continuously to the ultrasonic environment. So whenever a bat flies past, they'll make a recording, and a machine learning algorithm on board will detect whether it's a bat call and what species of bat made it. Those results are then in real time sent to a server and reported in real time. So whereas doing traditional bat surveys of a bat expert going out with a ultrasonic detector and listening to bats flying past and writing down in their notebook what species that was. Now we have quite a large area in a city being monitored continuously for the bats that are there. So it's giving us, for the first time, a long-term, real-time picture of what the bats are doing.
What are the sort of insights that you have gained already or hope to gain from this?
There's some assumptions about what bats do at different times of year. So certain times of year, like the autumn, they go off to swarming sites where they go and try and find a mate. And we didn't really think that would happen on the Olympic Park. But in about October time, we got these enormous peaks in bat activity, whereas in sort of July and August, we were having a few thousand calls every night. In October, we were getting sort of like 24,000 calls in one night. So there must have been some swarming activity going on in the park, which kind of suggests that the habitat on the park could be supporting some swarming behaviour. Something else that was really interesting for the people who manage the park, the London Legacy Development Corporation, they had, as part of the design of the park for biodiversity, had built kind of artificial bat roosting structures underneath the bridges. But as is very typical when it comes to these kind of biodiversity enhancements, no monitoring was ever done. It's all like, throw some money at it and we're just like, fingers crossed that it might work. And one of our sensors, sensor number 7 of 15, from as soon as we turned it on, it was just going crazy. Like every single night, thousands of calls, and we were sort of like emailing each other like, what the hell is going on with sensor 7? What's happened to it? And it turned out that it was next to one of these bat roosts that no one knew was being used, but was being used the whole of the summer by bats as a kind of artificial roosting habitat. So it was also the system showing that some of the investments that have been made in new habitat for the bats was actually being used, which was really nice.
So huge bat populations here in London that to a large extent we never really knew about and that you just don't notice.
Yeah, an awful lot of people have absolutely no idea that bats live in cities at all. And I guess that's because they're nocturnal, so they're out at night. They're flying mostly above your head, so if you're not looking for them with an ultrasonic detector, why would you know that they're there?
Yeah, good point. Yeah, I mean, let's talk a bit about how they get around then at night. Echolocation, I mean, what is it? How does it work?
So it's sort of like a very, very high frequency sound that bats emit at a very constant rate. So they'll be sort of flying around their environment, and some out of their mouth, others out of their nose, will be constantly emitting these very high frequency calls. And as these calls hit surfaces around them, they will bounce back, and the bats listen to that echo, and from that echo construct a mental image of the spatial arrangement around them. Yeah.
You have some of the sounds.
Yeah, so this is a really nice picture of probably the most common bat in London. So this is a common Pipistrellus, and this is the bat that just gets everywhere. And so that's the sound of... That's like a searching call. So it's like, these are its calls. And they're quite constant, and it's emitting it most of the time. And it doesn't take much energy for the bat to emit these sounds as well, because as its wing flaps go down, it kind of pushes out the air. So it's not having to expend much energy to create the noise, create the sound. So this is a Debenton's bat. So these are the kind of bats that really like to feed over water. So our sensors in the Olympic Park that are along the river pick up these bats a lot because they're flying up and down the river, and they kind of, what's called gleam, over the surface of the water. So they're kind of flying along the surface and catching the insects on the surface of the water. And this is a feeding buzz call. So as the bat hones in on an insect that it wants to eat, it will start to increase the rate at which it emits its echolocation calls, so it can create a finer detailed picture of the location of the insect, so it can kind of hone in on it and grab it. And I'll just play an example. So you hear it kind of like speeds up the rate at which it emits its echolocation call. By the way, I should explain, so these are spectrograms. So this is a way of visualizing an audio file. So this is frequency in hertz, kilohertz, and this is time. So humans can hear kind of about, adults about 15 kilohertz, kids up to about 20. When I've done talks for family groups before and asked children and their parents what sounds they can hear, very often the children can hear sounds up to about 20, but their adults and me included are more around like 12 or 15. But this is a way that we, these spectrograms we create to visualise the bat calls that we record. And most of them are around kind of 20 upwards. Some British bats call at around 20. And I think sometimes people can hear their echolocations when they're much lower. These are the calls of a common pipistrelle bat, so that's around 40 to 60 kilohertz. And this is a soprano pipistrelle, so it's another very common British pipistrelle species. And it's called soprano because it has a very similar type of call to a common pipistrelle, but it's just about 10 kilohertz higher in frequency. And I'm going to play you a social call. So bats also make calls to each other to communicate many different things. So they could be looking for a mate, they could be in distress, it could be a pup trying to find its mother and a mother trying to find the pup. There's very much less known about bat social calls, but they sound very sing-songy. Yeah, so there's kind of the three broad types of calls, echolocation calls that bats make.
Thanks. So you say that when they sound sing-songy, but we don't know what they do.
It's just an awful lot less research that's been done on the social calls. Possibly because there's so much more variety that they're a lot more difficult to study. But definitely there's a lot less known about them.
So we've got the first one's for kind of navigating the world.
Yeah.
And the second was the homing in on the prey, getting faster and faster.
Yeah.
And then these, something social.
Yeah.
But as to what the social lives of bats are actually like, do we know anything?
We know they're very gregarious, so they really like to hang out in groups. Mm. Their roosts can get enormous. There's a bridge in Austin, in Texas, where the world's largest colony of Mexican free-tailed bats roost underneath, and I think there's about 20,000 bats there. And when they first arrived, the people of Austin were really annoyed about it because there was guano everywhere, so it stank. And then tourists started to arrive to see the roost, and now the tourism industry based around this roost under this one bridge is quite lucrative, so it's like a really big deal now in Austin. And every night at sunset, they kind of take off in a big cloud of bats to go feeding.
And I mean, what do you think is going through the bat's head, as it were, when the bats echolocate? I mean, you said earlier that they form a mental image. What does you mean by that?
I mean, I guess it's quite difficult, as we will discuss, to really understand what is going on in the bat's brain when the sound returns. As we discussed earlier, there are some people who have developed echolocation, blind people, so they can possibly give us a better understanding of what it's like to create a mental image from sound. But yeah, I apart from, I guess, using the sound to create like a spatial image, I'm not really sure, to be honest.
So when you say that the bat creates a mental image, this is based on just the flexibility with which they navigate their environment makes you think they must have some sort of image in their head of the world around them.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, they seem to be able to, you know, they can hone in on these tiny little moving insects, which gives me the idea that they must be able to create a pretty detailed picture of what they're focused on.
Can't just be a kind of reflex, just seeing the prey and instinctively sort of going for it. There's something more flexible going on than that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure.
I mean, let's bring Craig in on this. I mean, as a philosopher, what are the questions you have when you look at when you hear those sounds?
Yeah, so I suppose one set of questions concerns the similarities and differences between echolocation in bats and vision in humans, which relates to the discussion about images. Because you might wonder whether echolocation in bats does something similar for bats as vision does for us. And one way you might describe vision for us, one of its functions is gives us a sort of picture of the world in which we can locate things and act on them, distinguish things. And perhaps one function of echolocation in bats is that, you know, it's nighttime, they're not seeing very well, but they echolocate and then they get those maps of the world. So I wondered, do you think it's plausible to try to understand bat echolocation as analogous to, maybe in terms of or with respect to vision in humans, or should we really be looking to emphasise the differences between those two forms of perception?
I know at least the research that I've read that tries to compare vision and echolocation often try to come up with analogies between how we use vision and how bats might echolocate. Bats use echolocation. So one of those analogies that I read about recently was this idea of having kind of motor memory. So apparently in experiments using baseball players, so a baseball player will, rather than watch the ball, they have created a model in their mind of knowing where the ball is likely to go. Mm. So their eyes will focus on where the ball is likely to go rather than where the ball actually is. And apparently bats do something similar with insects. So bats also create this kind of like model in their mind of how they know that insects move. So rather than watching the insects, their eyes will focus on the locations in which they expect the insects to move. So in that way, I guess, researchers are trying to use analogies between how humans use vision to understand how bats use echolocation.
So it's kind of a predictive model, that the bat is predicting where the insect will be.
Yeah.
I mean, are there important differences, do you think, between the way bats navigate the world with echolocation and the way we might navigate the world using sight?
I guess I try to discuss actually with my partner whether there's many similarities between the way different species use echolocation and the way humans use language. So different species of bat, all species of bats have different types of echolocation. So you saw the common pipistrelle that has a certain frequency, the call has a certain shape. Different species will call it a different frequency, and the call will have a different shape. And those characteristics of the call are developed through the bat's adaptation to its environment. So a bat that has a high frequency, steep, so wide bandwidth call is probably a species that lives in a very cluttered environment like a woodland. So it doesn't need to call, its call doesn't need to have an awful lot of power, because it doesn't have to call very far distances to pick up, you know, the clutter in the trees. Whereas a bat that lives in an agricultural environment, which is much more open, it needs to be able to call much further distances. So its call will be much lower in frequency and it will have greater power. So I was trying to think, okay, so do humans, is there something similar about how language adapts? Have different human languages evolved based on our environments? My partner seemed to think that that was a silly idea, but I tried to ask him, well, you know, you get a bit of a Cockney accent when we're in certain parts of London, and is that your form of adaptation to somehow fit into that environment?
It's a bit, with the song here, it's a bit reminiscent of what we see in Wales, an orca, where there's different calls for different groups in different parts of the world,
yeah,
different dialects.
Yeah. So even within species, I think you have different dialects, and even individuals can be distinguished based on different characteristics of their calls. So yeah, even within species, there are dialects. Yeah.
It's part of what makes it so incredibly difficult to imagine what it's like to do this sort of thing. Is that it's this mixture of hearing and sight and language, because it's kind of the noise is being made by the bats, a bit like language.
Yeah.
It's being heard, but it's providing this view of the world that is a bit like vision.
Yeah, yeah. So they're using it to see and also to communicate.
And there's just nothing like that. It's very hard to work out what sort of aspect of our own experience we can latch onto to try and make sense of the bat's experience.
Yeah.
Maybe there is none.
Yeah, and you mentioned the blind people. Yeah. Some blind people have developed a form of echolocating. Do you want to?
Yeah. I think it's only a small number of people. I don't think it's very common. But yeah, I think some blind people have developed a form of echolocation, which seems to work incredibly well. I've watched videos of this being done, and they can move through the environments very well and pick up quite small things.
What do they say about what it's like? Is it to them, is it like vision?
I don't know of anyone that's developed the skill of echolocating that has also had vision before going blind. So the only stories that I've heard of are people that were blind from birth, so they don't have a comparison of what it was like, what vision is like, and echolocation is like.
So you need both to be able to answer that question in a way. You'd need to have been able to see.
Yeah.
Well, should we take some questions from the audience then on this? You're already keen to jump in. We have a roving microphone.
Hello. Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. I live near Alexandra Palace, and they've had bat walks there where you get given one of these things that you can hear the bats and so forth. It's, you know, very interesting and instructive. It seems to me that trying to relate it to human experience can be very misleading. When I look at it, it seems fairly clear to me, and I mean, this is only how I look at it, that bats actually see by hearing. And what I mean by that is, I think it's a mistake for us to think that because it's sound waves and we start thinking about our ears and trying to, I think that's a mistake. And I think the bat, first of all, if you think about it, it's flying around with lots of other bats, avoiding the other bats, different species of bats, other insects, trees, and it's doing this at high speed and having no problem at all, never crashing into anything. It must have some sort of equivalent of a visual image, and it occurs to me that maybe we could look at the bat's brain and see if there's anything similar to the visual cortex, which is actually processing this information, that might actually tell us something. And the other thing is that regarding the blind people, they wouldn't, I've seen the same videos, you wouldn't expect them to actually be able to see using that, because they are not keeping up a constant chirping, if you like. What they're doing is they're going sort of like this, so they're getting occasional specified reflections off an object, whereas the bat is keeping up a constant, like a radar, effectively, sending out signals and getting the echoes back. The other thing is, I think the language thing is a bit of a red herring, in the sense that those social calls certainly sound a lot different from the echolocation calls, and I think that does sound something like a language of sorts.
Yeah.
I think that in terms of human experience, it's a bit like we use sight to avoid things and not to bump into things and to see something in the distance, but we also use sight socially to see that somebody is looking at us or smiling at us or expressing an emotion. And maybe in that way those differ, but the calls are, I think the functional call of the bat with the echolocation is simply something quite analogous to sight, and it must give the bat in some way, a bit like a sonar or something, I don't know, but in some way a picture, in inverted commas, of its environment. Otherwise I don't really see how it could handle it so fluently as it clearly does.
I mean, on that question of the bat's brain, I mean, what do we know about what is going on in the bat's brain?
I've seen some research that have shown that similar parts of the brain, in terms of humans and bats, are involved in the echolocation and vision. So we do think that is being looked into, and there does seem to be some overlap in the regions of the brain that are involved in echolocation.
They are,
bats,
yeah.
And
they have the neocortex, being mammals.
Yeah.
And there was a question from further back, I think. Yeah, second row from the back.
So one major difference, I suppose, between echolocation and sight is that you can see someone remain unseen, whereas obviously if you light something up with another member of your species up with your echolocation, they can hear you doing it. Do we know anything about how they use echolocation as well as calls socially? Do they image each other like they image insects? Do they listen to each other's echolocation bounces? Like, do they have cooperative hunting behavior? Does one light him up and the other one gets him? Like, do we know anything about that, or is that all mystery?
Yeah, definitely. So some bats will use a technique called jamming. So they will listen to another bat honing in on an insect, and then they will echolocate to kind of like mess up the echolocate, the feeding buzz of the other species. So the bat going in to grab the insect will miss the insect, and the jamming bat will swoop in and grab it. There's also some insects that are prey insects which can hear echolocation calls. So some bats will change the way they're echolocating because they're aware of this to catch certain species. So yeah, there's definitely some sneaky behaviour where some bats will listen to other bats and listen to insects and will use their echolocation to give themselves a competitive advantage.
Raises the question of how much the bats understand about the other bats. Do they realise there's another bat there echolocating?
Like I guess, they must.
Quite advanced social cognition.
Yeah.
Great. And so let's go just end of the fourth row from the back.
Thanks. So this is all very interesting to me because I'm much more from the sort of philosophy end of things. So all of this, you know, echolocation is on the greatest part new to me. So my question's a lot more simpler because I could probably Wikipedia this when I get home, but you could probably just answer better. How and when was echolocation discovered? How did they discover this? Who looked at a bat and said, no, he doesn't hear, he experiences consciousness through echolocation? Who discovered this, and when was it discovered, and how? And
God, I wish I knew the answer to this, although I know it's like a long time ago, and I know when it was found out.
How
it was
long, roughly?
Absolute disbelief. Like, people could not believe that someone was claiming that bats make sound to see. I know when that was first claimed, it was not well received.
Yeah.
A few hundred years ago. I'm sorry, I'm not sure.
Okay, that's great. Thanks.
There was another question from the very front.
Thanks. I'm just interested in, you know, if we saw in the pictures, a lot of these bats, they've got eyes. And I mean, not these ones here, but a lot of the species you see kind of in more tropical regions actually have quite big eyes and are kind of active during the day. So I was wondering, kind of, are there bat species in which vision, sort of ocular vision and echolocation, sort of coexist, and they sort of use both at the same time?
All bats can see, so that bats being blind is a misconception. Microbats, so they're the smaller bats, so all of the bats in the UK are microbats. they rely on echolocation primarily for predation. But the larger bodied bats, they will use sight for predation as well. And I'm not sure how much actually they do use their echolocation, but there's definitely a much greater reliance on vision for those larger bodied bats than the microbats.
Do the microbats use vision at all?
I think they use it for kind of closer range stuff. So in the roost, when they're in the roost, they won't be echolocating as much. They will be to visualise their environment. They'll be using sight a lot more.
Reminds me of a hybrid engine. Like where low speed, you've got the electric one, and higher speed, you've got the petrol one.
Yeah.
Are there any species of bat where these senses seem to be evenly matched? You know, they use the sight and the echolocation.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe there's like some kind
of. So always one is dominant.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. Right. Sorry.
And this question from third row, from the back.
Thank you. I just wondered what work has been done on sort of what kinds of algorithms the bats could be using. I guess we've got some idea of the processing power of their brains. We've got a good idea of what they can do. And I wonder whether there's been much work on the kind of information processing they might be doing, even if we don't know exactly what they're doing, with the hope that then we could build on top of that some idea of what kinds of perception, in the sense of what it is like, you might put onto that.
Really not sure. No, sorry.
Okay.
Well, there's another question from that row, and then we'll go back. Yeah.
If bats can in fact see, then it makes sense. What I had thought, what didn't make sense before, it makes sense that they could visualise. So, is it possible that what the echolocation does is really does produce a visual image or map in their minds? Is that a possibility?
Yeah, very possible, and I think the reason for the echolocation is because they're nocturnal. I guess if they weren't nocturnal, maybe they wouldn't use echolocation at all, but they've just evolved to take advantage of that niche of hunting at night rather than at day.
I guess it could be the very same regions of the brain that process the visual input from the eyes are also processing the input from the echolocation. Is that possible? Craig, do you want to?
Could I come in on this? Yeah. So I think we have to be slight, let's go a bit more slowly before we make claims like this. So one idea is that I like the phrase, the possibility that bats use sounds to see. And we're talking about visual images here. I think if we think that bats use sounds to form visual images, it's not clear that this is equivalent to the idea that they use sounds to see in anything like the sense in which we see, or perhaps they see with their eyes, because it's not obvious that when we see there's anything like visual images or pictures involved. One idea about seeing is that when you see, you're giving the environment, not an image of it or a picture of it. And another point to make is that from the fact that bats have quite fine-grained information about the spatial layout of their environment from echolocation, we can't move from that to talk of images or pictures, because that's to make a leap from, we've got information about the environment to, so it's in a visual format. But all we really know, isn't it, is that they've got information about their environment. So what's the extra premise that gets you the claim that it's in a visual format? That's the thing that I think we don't yet have information about, or at least not from what we've said so far. Mm.
Doesn't the same apply to humans, though? That you could say that we have information about our environment, but where are the pictures, so-called? It's just that we talk about it in terms I've got an image, or I can conjure up an image. And it just seems that a bat, it would be reasonable to say that a bat might have something similar, whatever similar means in that sense. But something that works as efficiently.
Let's go three rows from the back now. Another question.
Yeah, my question is quite similar to the couple of points that we've had before, which is around whether the senses always are translated into visuals, because I think humans are extremely kind of visual creatures, and we like to translate all of this into, you know, you hear these things and therefore we see images. But what research has been done with people who've never had sight, whether they have images or not, or whether this is just something that we're kind of forcing onto people or to creatures that have got no visuals, but actually that's unnecessary in terms of perception of the world.
I think that's
plausible. Yeah. I mean, let's shift then to more overtly philosophical questions then, shall we, Craig? And what is going on in philosophy that has led philosophers over recent decades to care about bats and to think of bats as being an interesting, significant example in the philosophy of mind?
I guess the answer to that is Thomas Nagel's article, What Is It Like to Be a Bat? From 1974. And in that article, Nagel was trying to raise certain questions about consciousness. And in order to get those questions going and to make the points he wanted to make, he found himself using the example of bats and the conscious lives of bats. So that's the starting point there for philosophy.
Let's talk a bit about the points he wanted to make and why bats seem like an example in which to make those points.
Yeah.
I mean, what was Nagel trying to argue about the nature of consciousness?
Right, so I think he was trying to do, there were two primary goals. One was to give us a framework for conceptualizing conscious experience, give us a sort of way of talking and a way of thinking about conscious experience. And then the more substantive goal was to argue against a trend that he found at the time, which was the trend of trying to just reduce conscious experience to purely physical goings on. So conscious experience is nothing but certain activity in the brain or the body. He was wanting to speak against that reductionist idea. Now, interestingly, he wasn't wanting to just say the reductionist idea is false, so he wasn't just putting forward a straightforward negative argument against it. He wanted to say we can't even understand what the reductionist is saying. So it was a rather complicated negative argument.
That we can't even understand what it means to say that conscious experience is a physical, material thing.
Yeah. The reductionist thinks that's a clear idea and says it's true. Nagel says, well, I don't know whether it's true or false, but it doesn't even make sense, at least at the moment. I mean, I could say more about the first thing, the conceptualization of consciousness from Nagel, if that would be helpful.
What the debate is about, that then the example of bats becomes important.
Exactly. So, this debate about consciousness, conscious experience, and he wants us to think of that with this, in terms of this phrase, what is it like for a subject? Hence the title of this this event. What is it really like to be a bat? So, what is it like for a subject to be a subject? That's one way he frames consciousness. You're conscious if there's something it's like for you to be the way you are. And he understands what is an experience. What is it for an experience to be conscious? Well, it's for there to be something it's like for you to undergo the experience. So to try and spell out what that means a bit more, since it's Valentine's Day, let's think of an example. We can think of certain states a subject is in. So now suppose that, Jonathan, you're in this kind of state, which is you are admired by a secret admirer, a truly secret admirer. And so they haven't revealed themselves to you, they haven't sent you a card, but they're out there and they love you deeply. But now ask this question, what is it like for you to be in that state? Well, there's nothing it's like for you to be in that state. It's unbeknownst to you. There's no bearing that has on you at all. Now suppose that someone offers you a rose but pricks you with the thorn and it hurts. What is it like for you? Well, now we can answer that question. It might be hard to articulate, but there's something it's like for you to undergo that experience. And for Nagel, that's just a way of talking about what conscious experience is. There being it's something it's like for you to undergo that experience. And so then the question becomes that kind of thing. Experiences where there's something it's like for you to undergo it. Can we understand that merely in terms of what's happening in the brain? And as we said, he's going to say that doesn't really make sense, or it's hard to understand what that claim would amount to. And his the way of getting us to that negative conclusion goes via the example of the conscious lives of bats.
So pain is one of philosophers' classic examples of a conscious experience, as you're saying, this idea that to be in pain just has this subjective, qualitative aspect to it, this almost kind of ineffability, something like that. But then pain is something that we're all familiar with, that we all experience, and so it's in a way hard to see there's a problem of understanding what it's like to be in pain, because we all know it as individuals. And that's kind of the way to bats, right, for Nagel.
Yeah, because what Nagel wants to loosen us up to is the idea that certain facts about consciousness we can't even conceive of properly, right? So you've just said facts about being in pain. Well, we can all sit here and sort of imagine that, understand it, talk about it, make some sort of sense to us. Now he says, okay, so let's think about something less familiar to us, and let's think about bats and the kind of activity you've been describing so well, this echolocation activity. Now ask yourself, what is it like for the bat to be a bat? And Nagel's answer is, we can't begin to answer that. It's not just that we can't know, we can't even conceive of it. And he has various sort of manoeuvres to get us to agree with him there. And so one of those is, well, how would you conceive of it? First of all, you start with your own case, you start with experience as you know it, and then you try and sort of modify it in your imagination so as you get to the perspective of a bat. But he thinks you'll never get there, you'll never get to the perspective of a bat. At most you'll get to the perspective of a human behaving like a bat. But that's quite different, right? And so in a sense, the blind individuals who can echolocate, that might give us a rich source of information, but for Nagel anyway, it's not going to get us to know what it's like for a bat to be a bat. It at most would get you to know what it's like for a human to do something similar to what a bat does. But there's a gap there. That's still understanding from the human perspective of human consciousness modified in a certain way. It's not getting you into bat consciousness, according to Nagel anyway.
So there's something...
Do you think that argument holds water?
It's an unfair question. I think it makes sense. Whether it holds water, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that's the extent of his argument. That's a step. Because he's then going to go on to try and use that step to argue against this thing I called reductionism earlier, or to argue about that. So,
Yeah, so the thought that, you know, there are some aspects of the bat's experience that will just defy any attempt of ours to explain it.
Yeah.
Through just understanding what's going on in its brain, describing all the neural mechanisms. We could have this complete account, right, of...
Yeah.
Of all of the brain mechanisms, all of the regions that are at work, everything they're doing, every single neuron, and we still wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
There'd still be something missing from that account.
Yeah, and that's right. And Nagel has a way to explain why that's the case. So he's saying, talk to experts like yourself, get all of the textbooks, look at the brains, have a complete study of bat brain and behaviour, and you'll still fall short of knowing and even conceiving of what it's like for a bat to be a bat. And here's why. He thinks that to understand what it's like for an X to be an X, right, bat, human, whatever it may be, to understand facts of those forms, you need the perspective, the point of view of the X in question. So you can't understand what it's like for a Martian to be a Martian unless you can occupy the perspective of a Martian. Likewise with bats, likewise with humans. We can understand each other and each other's conscious experience because we have we share a perspective. We don't, and he thinks, can't share a perspective with a bat, however hard we try, and thus we cannot understand or conceive of what it's like for a bat to be a bat. So perspective, point of view, is really crucial for Nagel.
So there are some facts that just can only be understood from within a particular subjective point of view.
Absolutely.
They just can't be...
That sounds like it's fallen
foul of his own argument. Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to the question of whether there's any way back for a materialist or reductionist from this. I mean, at the moment, let's just try and work out what the challenge is. Right, there's just some facts about the bat's experience that cannot be captured in any description from the objective point of view. philosophers sometimes like to use the term qualia here, right, where the painfulness of pain is supposed to be this ineffable quality about it, the redness of red, the blueness of a blue sky, this kind of ineffable quality. And sometimes the point is put in terms of maybe there's some ineffable qualities the bat is experiencing, and that's what can only be understood from a subjective point of view. Mm. Is that a good, helpful way of putting it?
Well, I'd find that the problem is if you read philosophical literature on qualia, then you know you'll find about 10 different definitions, and it's not very helpful.
Yeah.
So I find just working with particular examples, like understanding what it's like to be in pain, not understanding what it's like for a bat to echolocate, I think that's perhaps slightly more helpful way into the dispute rather than effability. I mean, effability in what sense? Qualia in what sense? I mean, those seem to add layers of complication that obscure the issue, really.
Maybe qualities is a better term than qualia, you think. But this ordinary sense of qualities, that when I look around the room, I see green, I see red, I see bright lights, darker areas, I see qualities.
Mm.
Oh, just got brighter. And when we think about the bat, what are the qualities that it's experiencing? It's not seeing, when it echolocates, it's not experiencing colours. Right? It's not experiencing the sort of things we experience when we see. What kind of qualities is it experiencing?
But suppose the qualities were the qualities we're familiar with, and that's disputable, but suppose they are. Suppose they're things, so put colour aside, but suppose it's things like spatial qualities, shape qualities, location qualities and so on. Suppose we fixed that and said, okay, so that's what the bat's getting. Does that help us to understand what it's like for a bat to be a bat? Nagel would say no. Because it's not just about the things given, the qualities, but it's the way they're given and the way they're experienced. And there you have something that we experience in one way, the bat experiences in another. So even bringing in qualities doesn't quite help us to make progress in conceiving of what it's like for a bat to be a bat.
We just have to understand the whole perspective.
Yeah.
And I mean, to come back then to this question of, has this finished off the idea of giving an objective, material account of what conscious experience is?
Well, Nagel wants to make a couple of moves in order to finalise his argument. One is that the notion of perspective and point of view is not just essential to experience, but in a way exhausts it. Because you might think, okay, so experience is perspectival. You always need a point of view. And then you might say, so can't that just be reduced to the stuff in the brain? And he says, well, let's think about what reduction is. It's where you have something that you have a point of view on, and then you go on to say what it really is. You abstract away from the point of view to get to its true nature. That's what reduction is. And he's saying, try and apply that to consciousness, and it just doesn't make sense. Because if you abstract away from the point of view, you've got nothing left. The consciousness is exhausted by this point of view of the subject. So there's nothing, you know, there's no real reality to experience beyond what is subjectively available. That just is experience. And so that's the final a move he makes to get us to see or to persuade us that it doesn't really make sense to suppose that you could reduce experience to physical goings-on. And one analogy he has to make this point is when people try to reduce lightning to electrical discharge. They say, well, what lightning really is this electrical activity. And he thinks that makes sense because you've got lightning as it appears to a point of view, to human subjects or to other animals, and then you kind of say, well, just forget about the appearance of it and then go to the real thing, and it's electrical discharge. Mm. He's saying, apply that to consciousness. Consciousness as it appears to a subject, consciousness as it involves a point of view of a subject, strip that away and find out what it really is. And he's saying, huh? Strip that away. That's what it is. You can't strip that away to get to its true nature. So he thinks reductionism doesn't make sense.
So just the usual strategy of science, he thinks, just cannot work in the case of consciousness.
Yeah.
Because you can't ask what's really going on behind the appearance in the way you can with lightning or rainbows.
Precisely.
Because conscious experience just is the appearance.
Exactly.
So this is quite a serious challenge, right? I mean, it's
yeah.
And not only to people who want to say conscious experience is something physical, but seems to anyone who wants to say that conscious experience is something objective, that there can be a scientific theory of.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's the subjective versus the objective in a way. Though he does have some speculative remarks at the end of the article about how perhaps you could make consciousness objective, but I don't quite understand what he's talking about there. So,
I mean, what's your view on this then? I mean, is there any... Is it completely misguided to try and have a science of conscious experience? If so, then a lot of neuroscience is on the wrong track.
Well, we can distinguish two questions. Science of what conscious experience is. For reasons Nagel gives, I'm kind of worried about that. I'm not entirely sure that that's going to be feasible. But the other question is science of what brings conscious experience about, what facilitates it, how you might intervene on it. Those things are very important, especially when you're talking about pain. If you have a science of pain, and you might want to know, so what can we do to stop this? Yeah. And a scientist can tell you about that, then great. So I think there is a challenge to a science of consciousness where the question is, what is consciousness? Yeah. But there's no challenge to the science of consciousness in the sense of science of how it works, how to intervene on it.
Right.
So and that's important.
You're asking, like, how do I relieve pain? Perfectly good scientific question. But you think if you're asking, what is pain? Fundamentally, what is pain? That's not a question science can answer.
Yeah, at the moment, I'm not entirely sure how we could. I'm no one to. I'm open to persuasion there, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, Alison, what do you think about all of this philosophy that starts with the example of the bat, right, and ends at this point where we're using the bat as a way of arguing that, to some extent, it may not even be possible to have a science of consciousness because it just defies any objective description. I mean, does it just seem ridiculous to you?
I have to say, I found the essay really hard to understand. Yeah, definitely took me way out of my comfort zone. I guess it kind of a little bit makes me feel like this. Some anthropomorphising of animals going on a little bit, sort of like we're trying to use like human qualities to understand an animal, perhaps, which these animals may have.
So are you skeptical? So where Nagel's kind of takes it for granted that the bats are conscious, and are you skeptical of that?
No, I mean, I found it quite interesting that the way consciousness seems to be defined is whether you experience pain or not, and that was completely new to me. Like, okay, so insects appear not to feel pain, so does that mean they're not conscious? Like, what? That seems ridiculous to me. Surely insects are conscious.
I think it's more like to get the conception of consciousness that we're working with. To give an example of it, we focus on pain. We don't make pain a condition on consciousness. So you might say pain is one example of there being something it's like for the experience to feel a certain way. But there could be other examples. So the point would be, as long as insects have some other examples of that, then they're conscious in Nagel's sense. Pain might not be the applicable example for insects, but as long as, you know, there's a way their environment seems to them, for instance, then that could get the discussion going instead. So I wouldn't think that pain was a condition on consciousness.
Okay.
I like the fact you say surely insects are conscious, as if there could be no argument about this.
I guess I just never considered that they wouldn't be. I don't know.
It's so, I kind of agree, but there is debate.
Yeah.
Makes you wonder what the ethical consequences would be if it were universally accepted that insects are conscious.
Yeah. Well, actually, doing a lot of the reading that I was doing for this, I was kind of shocked at how many experiments have been done on bats, even though we believe them to be conscious.
And there must be quite strong restrictions, presumably.
Stronger now than in the past. Like, some of the like older experiments did like really weird things to bats. Whereas I don't think you can like attach bats to wires anymore, which seemed to be something that happened a lot. You can still attach insects to wires and see how bats react to that insect, but I don't think you can attach a bat to a wire anymore, which I'm glad about.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You know, when it comes to insects, there's no regulation at all.
Yeah.
It sort of pins down why the bat is such a crucial example for Nagel, doesn't it? That he wants something where everyone will happily accept that it is conscious, because it's a mammal, it's got similar brain structures, it's got the cortex, and yet it has this mode of perception, this way of interacting with the world, that is just totally unlike anything other mammals have. So,
it's not all mammals, whales.
Yes. Right, so he could have said, what is it like to be a whale?
He could have done, yeah.
Hmm.
And he'd get the same results, I think.
Yeah. So in that sense, the example wasn't uniquely determined, but it does have this incredible intuitive...
It's a forceful example.
Force.
Yeah.
I mean, Alison, in your work on bats, do you feel this way, that there are fundamental limits on what science can actually tell us about bats? Or do you think this is kind of... the philosophers are inventing obstacles to science that don't really exist? Because you must wonder, right, when you hear them, you must wonder what it's like for them.
I guess I probably do some anthropomorphising of my own, as in, I guess, because they have, I guess because they're mammals, so they have some characteristics which I can relate to, like they are gregarious, they hang around in groups, they seem to form bonds with particular individuals, they seem to form favourites and preferences to things like where they like to feed and stuff. Mm. So those kind of characteristics, I guess, I can relate to. So that kind of makes me feel like, yes, they are conscious, because I can relate to how they live their lives. Or I think I can relate to that, because I see similarities in their behaviours to mine and humans.
Yeah, it kind of raises the question of whether you think there are things we can come to know about bats through kind of interacting with them as individuals that we can't know from scientific experiments and from kind of analysis of raw data.
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah, people keep them as pets, so they must be pretty nice to hang out with.
Really?
Yeah. There are many bat carers who will take care of bats who are injured, and some bats that can't be released into the wild become long-term, and they're often used for education and outreach. But I think they seem to be pretty nice pets. I mean, they're really cute. Like, I was never really, like, crazy about bats in that, like, gooey-eyed way until I actually held one recently, and then I was like, I get why people really love bats. They're really cute.
But they've never been domesticated. Right. It's kind of a wild animal in your house.
Yeah.
This sounds like something not advisable.
No, but I think there are some that live like long term with people.
Okay, so let's take some more questions from the audience then on this, shall we? In fact, on anything we've discussed, whether it's more related to the science or more related to the philosophy, anything would be great. Let's start with the fourth row back there.
Thank you. I think it's a really good question, because it does show up how we do anthropomorphize so much in the way we deal with the animal kingdom, let alone anything else. And I was thinking, when you were describing echolocation and saying they don't see colour, I was thinking about musicians that have had synesthesia, people like Scriabin and I think Arthur Bliss, so that in humans there is sometime a kind of bleed between sound and vision that is in the form of colour. Mm. I'm not saying that bats have that, but, you know, even, you know, or the person sitting next to you may be colourblind. You know, we kind of expect that even humans will be like us to a certain extent, but sometimes they really aren't. And I think it's a really good, useful question in terms of showing up that kind of laziness. I think it's a kind of lazy thinking. It just stretches our imaginations more. The other thing is that, this gentleman here said, you know, how skillful bats are in manoeuvring. I've actually been crashed into a bat on my bicycle, so I would certainly dispute that. And also my colleague here, in terms of how cute bats are, my colleague here pointed out that bats can actually carry rabies. So, you know, again, I don't want to go down this gooey-eyed, you know, route.
That would be a consideration against keeping them as a pet.
It's a very small proportion, but yeah, they do carry rabies.
This point about bats crashing into bikes raises this issue of how bats in an urban environment interacting with human stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, how does that work? Is this a significant problem, bats being killed by collisions with human vehicles?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of research that goes into road collisions. So motorways that cut through important bat habitat can get really high numbers of collisions. So there's a lot of research that's going into what kind of structures can be built over motorways to guide bats up and over the height of lorries. Mm. Yeah, it's a big problem.
And let's have a question from the third row from the back there.
Hi, yeah. I'd like to question this connection between experiencing something and imagining experiencing something. So if we haven't seen, for example, something, we can imagine, visualize it. Put it together from the elements of images that we've seen before, but at least we can imagine visually something that we haven't seen before. In terms of feelings, is it in general possible to experience or like feel something in our imagination that we haven't experienced before? So for example, if we dream that we fly, is it that we act and we feel something, like it feels like something when we're flying in our dreams? Is it because that we feel something in the dream and then we kind of put a picture on it? Or is it that the picture induces some kind of feeling which we think, you know, which is again comprised of different other feelings which you think that, okay, that may be like this? And another example is that, I don't know whether it's fiction or if it's true, but for example, in the Native American cultures, apparently they have these experiences, a bit like psychedelic, when they can bring themselves to a state when they actually experience being certain animals. And then they would tell that, okay, I was an eagle and this is like what I was feeling and seeing. Is it just something that, again, the tricks of imagination and maybe like drugs induce some sort of feeling and then we think, okay, that's, you know, maybe how an animal would think? Or, you know, could those sort of experiences can potentially help us understand something? Is it at all possible to imagine feeling something that you haven't felt before? Or experience a state that you've never been in just through the power of human imagination?
Question for Craig, I think. Mm.
I think, I'm sure a psychologist would be much better to answer this, but my views, for what they're worth, are that we need to distinguish between claims that certain things are being imagined and certain things being imagined. So it might be that certain people claim to imagine themselves as animals, and they might attest to that and they might describe it, but whether they're actually doing that is a different question. And to settle that, we need to get clear on something that's really unclear, namely, what would it be to imagine being an animal other than human? What would that even be? What are the success conditions of that? They can't just be, I said I was doing it, so I was. That's too easy. Mm. So what are the success conditions of imagining being an animal? And I don't know, but until we can get clear on that, your second question, I'm not really sure how we can properly settle that. Mm. The first question is whether you can imagine feeling things that you haven't felt before, and your interesting contrast with, you know, you can imagine seeing things that you haven't seen before, and perhaps often that involves putting together images that you have had and sort of coming up with something new. No one's seen a unicorn, but we can conjure up an image of a unicorn in our mind because, you know, you take the horse-like figure and the horn and so on. Can something like that apply to feeling? I don't see why it couldn't apply to modifications of feelings of pain and temperature. You know, you might not have felt sharp pain before, but you felt a range of pain such that you can kind of get yourself to imagine sharp pain. It doesn't seem inconceivable to me, but I'm not sure. Perhaps people with richer inner lives, and me can speak to that.
I find it very hard to imagine pain at all, really, isn't it? It's so, real pain is so different in its feel to attempts to imagine it.
Yeah. I mean, is that to say you can't imagine it with the same force as it would be in reality?
My attempts to imagine it just seems so attenuated compared to the real thing that I'm not even sure I'm really imagining it. Yeah. And there's another question from the same row. Yes, you had a question.
Yes, my question's fairly similar in that it's around perspective and kind of point of view. And so for Nagel, was he saying on a kind of human level that it's very difficult to put yourself in someone else's perspective and point of view? And if so, what does that mean in terms of empathy and being able to imagine other people and their situations? This is something I personally have been working on for the last couple of years. I've been making virtual reality pieces that put you in the shoes of someone else, so from the perspective of a baby or from the perspective of someone with autism. And it's incredibly hard because you can't, it's hard to take away the experience you've already got. And we found it incredibly challenging to do exactly that. And we've come across this barrier of like, you can't remove yourself in exactly that way. You can't become the bat, can't put the virtual reality headset on and become a bat. But yet, our whole kind of life and existence is about being able to try and transcend ourselves and imagine ourselves in other people's positions. And it's very hard to imagine living life and being able to kind of empathize with other people without imagining that is a possibility.
Excellent. Yeah, I think those are really great issues. In terms of what Nagel thinks, if I've understood him, he doesn't think there's a special problem with understanding others in the sense of me putting myself into your shoes and understanding you, because he distinguishes between particular perspectives and types of perspective. So it might be that I can put myself in your shoes and understand your perspective because we share the same type of perspective, if we're relevantly similar. If we're humans with similar background experiences. But what the difficulty comes in for him when you try and switch the type of perspective. So there's me understanding you, a fellow human, but me understanding a bat, that's not working within the type human, that's switching types. And that's where the problem comes for him. So it's not so much understanding each other, it's understanding beings who fall into different types and have different types of perspectives.
But can there be types of human, with people with particular conditions?
So he does think that it can be types, different types of human perspective too. And that links to your points about autism. Mm. So maybe that would be one example. It's not one of his examples, but I don't see why not. But one of his examples are, just compare the type of perspective you would have as someone who's had no problems with vision and the type of perspective another human would have who was congenitally blind. Or death, he uses those examples, right? So he does think you can have different types of types. You can have general types, like the human perspective, the bat perspective, and then you can have more specific types within those types, the congenitally blind perspective, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Good. So let's have a question from the row behind.
I'm interested in the comments made earlier about bats being very cute, and like some people liking to keep them as pets. And given that, what people would feel about the sort of folklore that's arisen around them, the way that they're often featured in horror films and this kind of thing. Thank you.
Yeah, they definitely have a stigma attached to them. I think the Bat Conservation Trust, who I work with, they have done some kind of public perceptions research into bats, and the proportion of the public that say are scared of bats, say they hate bats, is really shockingly high, actually. And I think they are really keen on trying to change public perceptions about bats. A project I collaborated on actually was with a user experience computer science student, and they made an arcade game like a really old-fashioned arcade game, which gave you information, some facts about bats. It gave you some information about some of the bats that we'd recorded at the Olympic Park. And he asked people before and after playing with this arcade game things about perceptions to do with bats. And it was a really interesting improvement in people's perceptions of bats after playing with this arcade game and reading some facts about bats and stuff. So, yeah, I think it's hopefully something that maybe could be easily changed, this negative public perception of bats. A lot of people seem to be very scared of the hair situation. But yeah, I think it's a really big, it's a big problem for bat conservation, is this negative public perception of bats.
The sounds are actually very endearing.
But we can't hear them.
Well, I actually meant when they've been reduced to wavelengths that I can hear.
Yeah.
Great. So let's come down to the front now. There's a question in the middle of the second row.
Yeah, I did have a pet bat once, and it was very cute, but very stupid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It may have been ill, because it died soon after. But on the subject of the irrational fear of bats, they're just like a lot of apparently irrational fears. People don't like snakes and spiders and things like that, but even bats in this country are infected by, not exactly rabies, but lentiviruses, which are very much the same nasty neurological and fatal thing.
Yeah.
So, and the Ebola, people think it actually came from bats. So, certainly in Africa, early humans that were frightened of bats or that had scary legends about bats would survive preferentially to people who thought they were cute and cuddly. So, just evolutionary point of view.
Yeah, they are reservoirs of a massive amount of horrible diseases. and a lot of research actually at UCL is going on looking into bats and diseases, about why they exist with so many diseases and viruses, and trying to predict where those viruses will spill over into human populations, as it did with the Ebola outbreak in Africa.
Thanks. And further questions?
I'm just wondering whether it's easier to think about what it would be like to be a bat just eating or doing something simple. So if you think about the perspective problem being the main one, if a bat is just, it's not flying, it's reasonably stationary, it's just undergoing peristalsis or something, it's feeling, proprioceptively what we might feel while eating. Do you think in those instances it might be possible, or is it that kind of experience is related to this whole complex array where there are so many impossible to imagine variables there that it kind of taints what would seem like a much more common kind of experience?
I suppose one question back to you, I don't know if this is fair, would be, suppose you're right and that you can, you genuinely can imagine or conceive of what it's like for a bat to do all sorts of things, like eat and so on. What would that get us then? Would that get us a genuine understanding of what it's like for the bat to consciously experience whilst undergoing such activities? Now, as a certain tradition in philosophy, which tries to understand experience just in terms of behaviour and dispositions to behave, might just say, yeah, that's all you need. But I suppose Nagel's sceptical about that position. So my response would be, okay, if we go with that, then even if that's true, Nagel's still going to say, but that doesn't get us what we want to get, namely a full understanding of the conscious lives of bats.
And there's a question at the end of the second row.
Hi, firstly to the three of you, thank you for such a fascinating talk and debate. Really interesting ideas being thrown around. Two questions, really just want to throw out these two ideas. First one, so it is actually possible to see sound and to see feeling and to hear visuals. Anyone who's ever taken a psychedelic will know that. And there's a group in Imperial College London that does a lot of functional MRI studies looking at brains of people taking psychedelics. And what they found is that there are pathways that are activated leading from the auditory cortex to the visual cortex. So I think these kind of things can help us understand how the bats do see things, because if we can imagine visualizing sounds or hearing visuals, then that can help us see how bats see the world. So that's my first idea. And then the second idea I want to say, you're speaking of this division of the subjective experience and that we can never really know what it's like to be a bat or another kind of species or even a human, and then the objective scientific reductionist view that even if we know all the neural pathways and all the positioning of the receptors and neurotransmitters at a particular point of time, we'll never really know what the feeling is. But why do we have to choose between the two? Maybe it's just the two sides of the same coin. For example, I'm experiencing pain, and this is what pain feels like to me. But if you're a scientist and you've got this perfect brain scanner and you can see what I feel like when I experience pain, you're just seeing the other side of the coin, and you don't really have to reconcile these two. To you, that's what the pain experience appears like as an outsider, and to me, that's what it appears like as an from inside. Anyway, yeah. If you want to comment on that, that'd be great. Thanks.
On the second point, I suppose one question is, how would we decide whether the objective is the other side of the coin of the subjective, or something independent of it that brings about or helps cause the subjective? Those are two different claims. So the first claim has it that the subjective involves or is partly objective. You know, you've got two sides of a coin, but it's one coin, right? And the other view is that these things are independent, the objective and the subjective, and they're linked in some sense. Perhaps subjective is partly caused by activity in the brain, but the brain activity isn't, as it were, part of the subjective experience or an aspect of it. How do you decide between those two views? So you mentioned the other side of the coin view, but what speaks in favour of that as opposed to the independence view, I would say? Mm-hmm. I think before we can get clear about how we would decide that dispute, I think it's not so helpful to just have the views out there. That is helpful to an extent, but we also need a sense of how would we go about deciding between them. It's not clear that any experiment would decide between them. What kind of philosophy could decide between them? Unclear too. Perhaps I could comment on the first point as well. I don't think it's obvious that we can see sounds. I certainly don't think it's obvious if the evidence for it is supposed to be that visual areas of the brain are active in some scenarios, perhaps drug-induced, in which sounds are perceived. That might show you a correlation between auditory perception and visualising, but it doesn't. It's a further step to say that the objects of vision in those scenarios are sounds, which is a claim that is hard to make sense of.
Let's see, we've got time for...
On that point, what's the difference between saying the objects of the sounds or the vision and saying that the sounds are causing these visual effects? It's a distinction that I'm struggling to see.
We can distinguish between causes of visual experience and objects of visual experience in general. You bring an orange down before my eyes and I see the orange. One of the causal antecedents to my seeing the orange, one of the causes, is the activity which involved bringing it down before my eyes. Now, I'm not seeing that activity. That's all sort of behind the scenes. But it's one of the causes that ultimately results in my seeing the orange. So there is a distinction between what you can see and what can cause seeing in general, as the example illustrates. Generating the sound might cause you to have a visual experience, but there's also a distinction between visual experience and seeing something. You might have sort of visual experiences of after images, hallucinations, and all sorts of visual experiences that whereby you're not clapping your eyes on anything. There's no object of perception. So I do think the distinctions hold up.
Let's have one more question.
Given that when the bats are in their cave, they're communicating to each other. I've got a philosophy question, which is, what might we learn by speculating in a bat forum where they ask, what's it really like to be a human being?
Uh, Are we assuming that if this is to be taken seriously, we're assuming that bats lack a sufficient level of intelligence to be having conversations in that sense, right? What kind of things do they communicate about? if not philosophy, then what?
Who they want to mate with? Do they want to stop mating with the person that they want to mate with? Where's my baby? Where's the good place to eat? I guess that's what we as humans can understand that they might want to talk about. They may be philosophical questions that they're discussing that we don't know about.
How much are their interactions kind of cooperative as opposed to nasty and competitive? I mean, you hear this example of the vampire bats, right, regurgitating blood for each other. It's kind of reciprocal sharing blood. But is it the norm that the bats actually get on with each other, or are they generally at each other's throats constantly?
Bats have been shown to have preference for different individuals, and they will behave more favourably towards other individuals. And also, I guess, like the jam example, they will also be competitive with other individuals for things like resources and for mates and stuff. So definitely, I guess, because they're gregarious, they will have a group which they're familiar with and individuals they'll favour, and others which they won't be so friendly with.
It's a mix of cooperation and competition.
Yeah.
Right. Perhaps one more question, if there is one. Let's have a question from the end of the fourth row from the back.
Hi, I was just wondering, fairly soon there's going to be a lot of autonomous cars driving around, and they actually use something which is similar to echolocation themselves. Would Nagel's argument, I guess you could say you couldn't know what it's like to be an autonomous car, but does that deny that an autonomous car would be conscious, or is the argument that there's something else which is conscious? Well, sorry, does it deny that you could deny them consciousness? Or is the argument that there's something else that is consciousness?
Nagel's argument would apply to autonomous cars in the sense that for the reasons he gives in relation to the bat example, he would also say you cannot conceive of what it's like to be an autonomous car. But that wouldn't imply that the autonomous car couldn't or wouldn't be conscious any more than the discussion of bats implies that bats aren't conscious. But Nagel thinks they are. So his point is that there are aspects of consciousness that are inaccessible to humans, right? And the reason being, we can't occupy all of the perspectives, such as the bat perspective, the autonomous car perspective, right? And that means there are aspects of consciousness that we cannot fully conceive of.
And it raises this possibility, right, that just as we sit around now talking about are bats conscious, are insects conscious, we don't really know. How do we tell? In the future, we may be asking these questions about robots, AI, equally troubling in a way. Mm. Great. Well, thanks, everyone. I'm afraid that's basically all we have time for.